This episode is brought to you by UiPath. Human achievement can be slow. 200,000 years to go from the wheel to your jalopy? Really? But today, 90% of the Fortune 500 are accelerating human achievement simply. When AI is everywhere, every process can be automated and accelerated. 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 UiPath, the AI everywhere foundation of innovation.
This episode is brought to you by Funnables. Funnables aren't just fruit snacks. Every bite your child takes is fuel to spark their imagination, taking them from a wild unicorn space mission to a deep sea dive into a rainbow river. Funnables are made with 7.1% real fruit puree and are an excellent source of vitamins A, C, and E. So anytime, anyplace, make snack time playtime with Funnables fruit snacks. Have fun. Eat it too. Visit FunnablesSnacks.com to shop now.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the History of World War II podcast, episode 64, The British and the Mediterranean in 1940. With us today is Andrew Lambert, the Lawton Professor of Naval History in the Department of War Studies at King's College London, and the director of the Lawton Naval History Research Unit. He's the author of 10 books and at least 18 major articles on the British Navy, and his latest book is Challenge: Britain Against America in the War, in the Naval War of 1820. I've already ordered my copy, but as an American, I'm sure it's going to be a painful delight to read. So, Professor Lambert, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. All right. My pleasure.
Thank you. So, tell you what, let's just jump into this, and let's set the scene. It's the summer of 1940. The French are out. The British have taken action against the French fleet that they felt was necessary in Operation Catapult and other points besides Mails Air Kabir. At this point, the U.S. President Roosevelt has no way of bringing America into the war. The British have been pushed out of certain frontier posts in Eastern and Central Africa. The Italians are at Sidi Barrani in overwhelming numbers. The government of Egypt has declared not to fight unless directly attacked. The situation in the Middle East is unstable as far as politically. The Arabs are keenly watching what happens to the British Empire, and in fact are watching with a sharp eye as far as the Battle of Britain to see what will happen to the home island. General de Gaulle and General Spears have been repulsed at Dakar. And lastly, the Italian Navy is in the Mediterranean in impressive numbers, but at least on paper. So, Professor Lambert, if you could set the scene for us, with the British having their ally taken out of the war, I mean, exactly what was Cunningham, the acting admiral, thinking at that time, or what? How did they see their situation at this point in the war?
The British have lost the Battle of France. France has collapsed. Britain is not going to fight Germany in Europe. The British simply aren't going to have enough men to fight the Germans, so they retreat to fight a proper British war, a war of sea control, power projection, and industrial and economic mobilization. But to do that, they need to control the Mediterranean. The problem in the summer of 1940 is that the French had actually taken control of the western half of the Mediterranean under the alliance with their fleet at Mers El Kabir and Toulon. And the British were in the eastern half, the beyond Italy, based mostly at Alexandria on the coast of Egypt. So with the French taken out, the British suddenly found themselves with only half enough ships in the Mediterranean and all at one end. So the first thing they did was to detach a strike force called Force H of a battle cruiser, an aircraft carrier, and some destroyers down to Gibraltar, essentially to seal off the entrance to the Mediterranean against surface ships and to provide options for running convoys through to Malta. Malta is going to be the pivot of everything that happens in the Mediterranean. Right. It's the greatest natural harbor in the Mediterranean. It's exactly halfway between Gibraltar and Alexandria. It's just off the coast of Sicily. It's just off the coast of North Africa. It is the choke point between the two halves of the Mediterranean. And it's a first-class naval base, which the British have been using in peacetime for their fleet.
Right.
So the British want to keep Malta. It's an airfield, it's a submarine base, it's a flotilla base, and it's really the hub of so much of what they're going to do. Keeping Malta is going to give them the option of using the Mediterranean If they lose Malta, they will lose the Mediterranean, and they will probably then lose Egypt as well, and with that, potentially the war.
Right.
So the stakes couldn't be higher. The problem is that everybody in Britain is watching a lot of Messerschmitts and Spitfires fighting over the coast of Kent and Essex.
Right.
And the Battle of Britain takes inevitably priority. It really is more important to the people in Britain. But the Mediterranean is critical. And the British fleet in the Mediterranean, in three battleships and aircraft carriers and cruisers and destroyers, is very small.
Mm-hmm.
The Italians have twice as many ships, at least, and at least six times as many submarines.
Wow.
The Italians outnumber the British by 3 or 4 to 1 in most categories, slightly less in capital ships.
Mm-hmm.
So if the Italians are going to fight the British on the level, they're going to win this competition. They've got more ships, they've got more men, they've got a lot more airplanes and a lot more submarines. If they can just bring everything together and use them effectively, they can win this.
Right. But
the problem is the problem is that the British fleet is very confident. Now, many of the units in the fleet have already been in battle with the Germans during the Norway campaign, and they have no doubt that when they meet the Italians, they will defeat them. The Italians are good sailors, and they run their ships well, but the British don't think that they're on the same level as themselves. So they have every confidence that they're going to win. And the opening encounters will demonstrate that there's a significant difference in the morale of the two fleets.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the physical assets. You know, navies are not about ships. They're about people. And if your people believe and have the quality, then you will prevail, even if your equipment isn't perhaps quite as numerous or outstanding as the enemy.
Right.
So very early on, there's an engagement off the south coast of Italy at Punta Stilo on the 9th of July when the British flagship, HMS Warspite, lands a hit on the Italian flagship, the Giulio Cesare, and the Italians retreat.
Mm.
And that's the last time that they faced the British willingly in battle for the rest of the war.
Wow.
There's at the heart of all of this, there is a commanding personality. On the Italian side, they have some good admirals, but the British have a much better admiral. Andrew Cunningham, who's going to command the Mediterranean for the next 3 years,
mm-hmm.
from the darkest days of the war right through to Operation Torch, Husky landing on Sicily, and Anzio. He's an extremely experienced Viking sailor, very determined man. And he knows that if you get on top of the enemy in morale terms, if you impress the enemy with your determination, your skill, and your power, it doesn't matter that you're a few ships short. You've got the enemy half beaten because
right.
he knows that you will attack. He's highly aggressive. He knows that the best way to deal with an enemy fleet is to attack them. Whenever he gets the chance, he's organizing large, complex operations to move men, ships, and material to keep the army supplied, to make sure the army can defend Egypt critically, to keep Malta supplied, and mm-hmm. to bring in the reinforcements that he's slow receiving to get his fleet up to strength to take the war effort on. So really, in the opening 2 months of the war in the Mediterranean, his job is just to keep the Italians quiet, just to keep them on the back foot, as we say in England, on the defensive.
Right.
And he manages that remarkably well.
And the British really needed that. I mean, like you said, they were holding their own in the Battle of Britain, but it probably didn't feel like that to them. And any good news they could get, especially out of the Mediterranean, which is very important to them, is going to lift their morale until the Battle of Britain is more conclusive, because they're just not sure how well, you know, with hindsight we know, but how well they were doing.
Absolutely. What's interesting, of course, is that at the height of the Battle of Britain, Churchill, who's only been Prime Minister for a few weeks, decides that the only armored division the British Army actually has, the only fully formed tank division, will be sent to Egypt. The British aren't expecting the Germans to be able to invade. They send their only armored division straight to Egypt because they expect that the next round of land fighting will be against the Italians, and it'll be in Libya. So people who are in the know in Britain are quietly confident that the Germans cannot come, because to invade England, you have to come by sea. And the Germans are not going to do that. They don't have any navy left after the Norway campaign.
Right.
They don't have any invasion shipping. They don't have the lift to carry enough men. They don't have a place they could land those men. They don't have proper landing craft. They haven't done any serious reconnaissance. And it's quite clear the German army had no intention of putting to sea in face of the Royal Navy. So the Battle of Britain is a very good public relations exercise. Mm-hmm. It's very heavily marketed in the United States. Look at the British. We've got a better fight than the Germans, and we're winning the Battle of Britain. It's mostly propaganda. And the Battle of Britain is a score draw, quite a high score draw. The Luftwaffe can't beat the Royal Air Force. The Royal Air Force can't beat the Luftwaffe.
Right.
But because the Luftwaffe can't win, Germany can't possibly hope to invade. So the Battle of Britain is fought out to a stalemate. And in this period, the Navy in the Mediterranean picks up strength and critically acquires a brand new aircraft carrier.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
So we get to the point where very early on, Cunningham has displayed a moral ascendancy over, or I guess I should say, an intimidating presence over the Italians. Even though they have, like you said, they have all these assets, he has either the attitude or the personality. He's going to bring the fight to them. They start to back off. General Graziani's in Egypt, barely. He's stalling. He doesn't want to go against the British land forces. And then we come to the Battle of Taranto in the mid-November. Could you tell me about that, please?
Yeah. The British invented the aircraft carrier in the First World War. And in the middle of 1918, they carried out the world's first aircraft carrier strike operation against Antwerp. Which is a Zeppelin ship. And from 1920, they'd been working on how to use air carriers to strike enemy fleets that were going in harbor behind defenses. This was the dream of all British admirals, from Francis Drake out to Peter. Can we go in and get them? And so the British craft carriers and the British officers running them emphasized the strike on targets. And an obvious target, given how few major navies, there were the Italian naval bay on tow. So by 1930, the British were exercising attacking enemy naval bases just like Taranto. And when Cunningham gets a new aircraft carrier, which is a brand new armored deck aircraft carrier, he moves quickly to put this operation into practice. This isn't something he comes up with. This operation has been planned many years before. So the fleet carries out a complex series of operations, so the Italians aren't sure the main British objective is. What Cunningham is doing is moving convoys in different parts of the Mediterranean. He's reinforcing and relieving ships' formation. So from the Italian perspective, not clear what the object of all of these British movements are. They interlock, they intersect, but the ultimate remains shrouded. The Illustrious gets in the position to fly off, and it's over 20 Swordfish torpedo bombers. These are the famous biplane torpedo bombers the British used the entire war.
Right.
They fly at night. The British are planning night carrier operations, and so the whole of this operation conducted at night. Take off, flight to target, strike, return, air landing. It's all in darkness. They lose two aircraft to anti-air fire. And they sink three Italian battleships, which put Italian and battle fleet out of operation for a considerable period of time.
Wow.
Further shatters their morale. They're not even at sea, and the British have turned up in the middle of the night and sunk them.
Right.
It's a stunning operation of war. And remember, it's only just over 20 torpedo bombers. This isn't Pearl Harbor with 100 plus planes. It's
right.
20. It's all the torpedoes hit.
That's amazing.
The success rate to hit on ship, very, very high. And with that, Cunningham has now got the Italian fleet off the board. He's got a carrier with a few good fighters on, and particularly important, he's got radar, and he's got radar-controlled fighter aircraft. This is the first time that it's seen in naval warfare. Developed a method of using fighters with radar and voice control from the ship. Mm-hmm. So the few fighters they have can be very effective on incoming targets. This is the system that will be so effective in the Pacific War.
Right.
A combination of radar, control, and so that you can see the enemy strike coming in and intercept it before it arrives over the target. And for the rest of the year, the British have almost complete moral ascendancy. The results of Taranto mean that the Italian fleet retreats up to central northern Italy. There are really very few things the Italian fleet can hit on, but they're really not taking much effort against the British. This means that the Italian army in North Africa can go and get its supplies. It means the British can move ships, the Italians can't. And logistically for the Italians, it's a nightmare.
That's amazing.
So Cunningham has the initiative. The problem is that the Germans respond to this fairly quickly, as the Germans tend to do, having noticed they have a major problem. The Italians are not able to deal with the British. They send Flieger Corps, which is the specialized Luftwaffe anti-shipping unit, down to Sicily, and all of a sudden tables are going to be turned pretty swiftly. In the first week of January, a series of operations result in damage to Cunningham's flagship, the Warspire, the Illustrious, and some of the large cruiser. So all of a sudden, having beaten the Italians and complete control over them, the Germans come in, and the Navy is now in a very difficult position. They're up against a big, well-organized and very professional aviation strike force, and they have problems.
And not only that, but now that the war in Greece has started, the British are trying to resupply forces and supplies there, and they still have to a certain degree, deal with the Italian Navy that is being goaded by Germany. Now, it's in some ways, it's political master telling them to keep trying, even though they don't want to, and they certainly don't have the technological means. One of those in particular is the Battle of Cape, is that Matapan in March of 41?
Yeah. Yeah. What's interesting is that the British detach troops from their victorious army in Libya and send them off to reinforce Greece. This isn't going to work because the Germans are taking part in the invasion of Greece, so Greece is going to fall quite swiftly. The British don't have enough power, military power, to save Greece. And those forces then get evacuated back to Crete, and they then have to be evacuated. But in an attempt to cut off the British reinforcements moving into the Greek theater, the Italian Navy comes out with their undamaged new battleship, the Vittorio Veneto, and a large force of cruisers. And they're searching for British convoy. The British know what's going on because now the Germans are here, the British can read German intelligence traffic. Its codes are secure. The German ones, particularly the Luftwaffe codes, are already vulnerable. German naval codes have held out, but the Luftwaffe is a very slack organization, and the British have broken Luftwaffe traffic. So the problem for the Italians is not their fleet or their operation, it's that the Luftwaffe are doing the scouting for them.
Right.
So everything the Luftwaffe tells the Italians by radio, the British pick up. Cunningham is able to get out with three battleships, an aircraft carrier, a new aircraft carrier, the Formidable, and some destroyers. He very nearly catches the entire Italian fleet. It's touch and go. He torpedoes the Vittorio Veneto, but the ship is still able to maintain speed and get away.
Right.
He then, in second strike, then cripples one of the Italian heavy cruisers, the Polar. She's left dead in the water. And later, the Admiral sends back two other cruisers to go and pick up the Polar. Unbeknownst to them, because they don't have radar, they stumble into the British battle fleet.
Wow.
And all three of these ships are then sunk very rapidly at very close quarters, along with the two destroyers. British casualties, about three. Italian humans, Italian casualties, three big cruisers, two destroyers, and several thousand men. Really, the Italian Navy's morale is not going to recover from this. Right. And the idea of fighting the British in a stand-up naval battle goes away at this point. So the British find themselves in a difficult position. They have mastery on the surface of the sea. And during the evacuation of Crete that follows, they're able to move on the surface, but they're under constant air attack. Mm-hmm. And within months, there will be German U-boats as well as Italian submarines in theater. So they start to take losses from both air attack and from submarine attack. And really, by the end of 1941, by the time of Pearl Harbor, for example, the Royal Navy in the Mediterranean is run down to a very low level. They've got damaged ships, lost ships. They're just running out of resource. They're really coming to the end of what they're capable of doing. It's not the naval fighting. It's the support of the army. It's moving in convoys. It's trying to use sea power against an overwhelming air threat. It's really not until 1942-43 that the situation changes, when the British get more ships, they get more equipment, and when we get to the Torch landings at the end of 1942, the Mediterranean is then reopened, and this vital strategic waterway is then once again being used to move men and materials from Northern Europe through to the Far East, and to link up the two halves of the World War, the European War and the Asian War. And it's the Royal Navy in the Mediterranean that just holds that line open for the duration of the conflict. But it's a real rollercoaster ride from the high points of Taranto and Matapan, some very low points of battering they received off Crete only a few months after Matapan, right at the way down to the end of 1941, when they start to lose significant numbers of ships. So it's very difficult. The one thing you can say is that the Royal Navy understands that fighting at sea does involve losing ships.
Right.
The Italians and the Germans tend to make a fetish out of saving their ships rather than using them. Navies that don't use their ships and don't try to gain control of the sea end up surrendering at the end of the war without losing many ships. The Germans in the First World War will be a very good example. Their entire fleet was still there at the end of the war. It had done nothing. The British weren't going to make that mistake. They lost ships and they lost people, but they won the campaign.
That's amazing. I mean, yeah, like you said, the roller coaster ride. Excuse me. First, Britain and France has a plan, and then France is out, and the Italians look impressive, but Cunningham takes the war to them. They're able to dominate the Italians. Then the Germans come in. And like you said, the British are going to do what they can, but in the process, they are going to lose ships, and it's just going to get harder and harder for them. I think I read somewhere that, was it the Battle of Taranto, that the Japanese studied that very carefully and used it against the Prince of Wales and Pearl Harbor in the future?
The Japanese naval attaché was in Taranto within a day of the attack. There's a photograph of him standing on the steps of the Italian Air Force officers' mess, having come down to see what had been done and to work out how to do torpedo bombing in a shallow harbour. The British had made this work very well. So it certainly has a bearing on the Pearl Harbor attack, which was a carrier strike from the sea against a fleet in harbor. And Pearl Harbor is a larger scale version of what the British do at Taranto, with, of course, the exception the British were already at war with the Italians when they attacked. The attack on the Prince of Wales and repulse off Malaya at the same time is a slightly different operation, because that was land-based twin-engine strike aircraft, which proved to be very successful. That was a particularly impressive piece of Japanese development. They have ultra-long-range aircraft carrying torpedoes over very long distances, which provided an element of technological surprise that the British hadn't anticipated. But certainly, the Japanese are in Europe. They're working closely with the Italians and the Germans, and they're picking up anything they can, not just from their ally, but also from the experience their allies are having at the hands of the British. And as the Japanese Navy had always learned from the British from the very beginning, Indeed, it still has traces of that British heritage in it to this day. They were particularly interested to see how the old masters were still carrying on. The Japanese knew that aircraft carriers were invented by the British because the British taught them how to use aircraft carriers in 1920, as they did the Americans and the French.
Wow.
You know, the aircraft carrier was a British invention, and the British were quite generous. They allowed everybody to come along and have a look and learn. So what we see by the end of 1941 is the Japanese have had another best part of 18 months to digest the results of those operations and to come up with their own variation on that. Not one aircraft carrier, but six, not 20 planes, but 350. And the thing to say about Pearl Harbor is, given that they were sitting ducks on Sunday morning and weren't expecting it, the success rate was remarkably low. You know, if that attack had been conducted in a thoroughly professional way, you would have expected to have sunk everything.
Right. Whew, lucky for us.
You know, the losses were heavy. Yeah, absolutely. I think things got a bit confused on the day, and it looks like too many planes were trying to attack the same targets at the same time. I think the operation, you know, began to break down, and there was a loss of control on the part of the strike leaders.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Right. If I can ask about the Mediterranean. So as far as I can tell, the Germans bring in aircraft and submarines to help deal with the British naval vessels in the Mediterranean. So is it a combination of those two things plus whatever the Italians could bring to it that made the British have such a hard time in 41 and 42?
Yeah, the arrival of Luftwaffe and then of the U-boats provides a cutting edge to the Axis war effort, which the Italians, you know, hadn't been able to provide. So the capital ship sinkings at sea are German submarines. The aircraft carriers, the Arkwell is sunk by a German submarine. The Illustrious and Formidable are put out of action by German aircraft. What the Italians bring to the party is the numbers of ships. They do very well escorting their convoys across to North Africa. They put up a stout fight there, and they take a heavy toll on British submarines trying to interfere with that traffic. They're providing all of the lift. You know, the Germans don't get to North Africa in German ships. The Italians take them.
Ah.
And the Italians keep fighting that convoy battle right to the end of Mussolini's regime when it collapses in 43. So the Italian Navy is out there. It takes very heavy losses. You can't fault them for their commitment, their determination. They were perhaps not quite as, you know, professional in the fighting sense as the British, but they were certainly no problems with their determination or commitment. And if you look at a list of the Italian Navy in the Second World War against most ships, you'll find sunk. They lost very heavily, whole classes of escort vessels wiped out in convoy battles.
Wow.
And a lot of their merchant ships as well. They put a huge effort into keeping that war going, and they took a real battering.
That's amazing. I'm very curious about Cunningham. You said he's around until 43, I think you said?
Yeah. Cunningham is one of those rare, exceptional people. I wrote a book called Admirals a few years ago. I looked at the evolution of the business of being an admiral from the Spanish Armada through to the Second World War.
Oh, wow.
I used him to exemplify what naval command looks like at the end. He has a very effective staff system. He commands the whole theater from the bridge of his flagship. He's relentless and determined. He uses his staff up, you know, like oil and petrol in their car. When they get exhausted, he just sends them home and gets some more. But he's handpicking the people who will be leading the Royal Navy at the end of the war.
Mm-hmm.
The British fleet in the Pacific was led almost entirely by people that had been part of his team. He picked the best. He developed their careers, and when the war in the Far East ended, the senior officers afloat with that fleet were all Cunningham's men. He is the last old-fashioned great admiral. You know, when he comes ashore in 1942 and no longer commands from the flagship, it's the end of an epoch in history, a 500-year period when admirals command great fleets and great theatres of war from the flagship. He's the last to do that. And it's, you know, it's very much the end of an era. But his relentless determination, his overriding professionalism, and his obsession with getting a grip on the enemy and making the enemy bend to your will. This was a man who'd never let anybody interfere with his career. He made his career. He avoided all the appointments he didn't want. He commanded the same destroyer for 6 years because he was so good nobody dared remove him.
Right.
Really an exceptional human being. And then in 1943, he had to go back to London to take over and running the Admiralty as the first Sea Lord because Admiral Pound had died.
Right.
He didn't want to do it because he didn't like being a desk officer, but he knew that it had to be done and knew that given his rank and his celebrity that he was the man who had to do it. And so he carried that burden right down to the end of the war, and he made sure that the Navy was in good shape before he retired.
That is
truly one of the half dozen really great men of the Second World War.
Wow! So you said he's covered by in your book called Admirals.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's the last of the last of a long and illustrious line.
Okay, that will be the second book of yours that I buy today. So I'm really looking forward to that. I can't wait to cover him more in detail. So, again, I just want to thank you very much for spending your time with us. The Mediterranean makes a lot more sense to me now and hopefully to my listeners. And, again, I just really appreciate it. Is there anything you would like to end? I think we've covered the Mediterranean. Maybe sometime in the future, if it's okay with you, we could talk about the Atlantic because that's something I will be covering after I finish up North Africa in 1940.
Yeah, that would be happy to do that.
Excellent.
Yeah,
so,
that's fair.
I'm not trying
to that.
Good. I'm not trying to push all my work off on you, but hey, if you can get someone who actually knows
no,
what
no.
I'm talking about, that would be great.
Well, now it's always good to have a chance to address a new audience. So
Thanks.
It's been a great pleasure.
Excellent. Thank you, Professor Lambert. Thank you for everything, and hopefully I will be talking to you soon.
All the best.
All right. Take care.
Thanks very much.
Bye.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.